The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello again. This is Austin Wintory here to once again sit in for Ted/Robin. And I am interviewing this time at GDC, Jason Graves, a composer I've been friends with a very long time, whose work is consistently amazing and terrifying. We talk about certainly his most famous score like Dead Space, Tomb Raider, The Order 1886, and innumerable others. There's also sarcasm aplenty and no sign of actual personal charisma between he and I. So I hope you enjoy it, and this is not the end of you listening to this podcast now.
Welcome to the Game Maker's Notebook, a podcast featuring a series of in-depth one-on-one conversations between game makers providing a thoughtful, intimate perspective on the business and craft of interactive entertainment. The Game Maker's Notebook is presented by the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences, a member-driven organization dedicated to the recognition and advancement of interactive entertainment.
Jason.
Austin.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm excellent. Are you enjoying the intimacy of the Intercontinental Hotel room here at GDC?
Best interview room I've been in all day.
Yeah. Oh, good. Good. Well, we'll see if we can hold that bar steady. I want to just hear. I want to hear stories from the front lines of being Graves, but since you're here at GDC talking about Moss, which is the least Gravesian endeavor by reputation.
Yes, it is.
That seems like a fun jumping off point before we inevitably just listen to or talk about aleatory and musical violence. So, yes, tell us about Innocent Farm Animals.
Oh, man, that game. So amazing. And this little, you know, this little mouse in VR that you see as scale, like a little mouse, and you are like full sized. And, you know, the funniest thing taking on where you just mentioned the least Gravesian is the audio director, Stephen Hody, contacted my agent looking for a composer. And I was one of the ones that Cheryl suggested. And I don't know the exact details of the conversation, but when she mentioned my name, Steven immediately said, oh, it's not that kind of a game.
Yeah, exactly. There's minimal amounts of necromorph
no skeletons,
violence.
You know,
and,
no face melting or, you know.
Yeah. Well, I hear that they're going to, you know, they're adding that in to accommodate you because otherwise it's
yeah,
just not an authentic.
Yeah, that's in the DLC. Yeah, it's going
like
to be
the zombie
like,
mode of
yes,
Call of Duty kind of thing.
Exactly. So it was.
How'd you get, so that gets, I mean, we're kind of, I realize I should have prompted you to give a little bit of just broad background on yourself. So we'll circle back and do this all kind of asynchronously because for those people who are listening who don't know your work, they don't realize that it's actually a backhanded compliment that they would say it's not that kind of score
right,
because
right.
Your reputation is so immensely solid for those kinds of games. Like it's not built on some cliche stereotype. It's built on this body of work that's pretty amazing.
I appreciate that.
The fawning will stop at some point. Don't worry, we'll be busting your balls shortly. But yeah. So, I think. Well, tell me more about Moss, and then I want to just kind of back up and hear you know the Jason Graves story tonight on VH1.
Oh, that behind the music.
Yes, behind the shrieking.
Behind the muffled screams.
Yeah.
The Moss thing. I got the pitch packet. And it had, I'm a big animal person, so we'll just go ahead and
yeah,
say
I suppose
that
people
right
should
now.
Realize that you basically run a halfway house for most species on record.
Yeah, real. I mean, lots and lots and lots of animals.
There's going to be a big game audio scandal when it turns out you're one of those illegal, like, dealer, animal
like
pet people that have
orders.
You know, yeah, yeah. It's like you're running the exotic animal version of a puppy mill.
Yeah, I mean, anything.
You really
like
shouldn't be breeding pandas.
I know, but, you know, they're so cute.
Well, I know, but they grow up. Yes, so you have like a farm.
Yeah, I mean like 80, 90 something different animals, but no cows or any. Goats are the biggest that we get, but lots of chickens and ducks and parrots and tortoises and rabbits and bearded dragons and pythons and like hissing cockroaches, you know, chinchillas, dogs and cats.
Normal pet store fare. It's just literally everything in the pet store.
More or less. Like
catalog.
I walked into a pet store that was a big chain, and it had all these black and white like silhouette icons of different animals. And I actually took a picture of it and posted it on Twitter and said, is it good or bad if you own all of the animals on the welcome to this pet store?
I'll have one of each, please.
Yeah, and like more than one of each. So being a huge animal fan and really kind of first starting out loving like Jerry Goldsmith and John Williams and the more melodic sort of lyrical stuff.
Yeah, Secret of Nim kind of territory.
Oh my gosh. What a great analogy. Yeah. You know, I never even thought about Secret of Nim for this because she is a little mouse. Or Tale of Despero. Someone pointed that out to me.
Bill Ross,
I think. A week ago. Yeah, which was another great score. But I got the pitch packet, and on the first page was like a mouse riding a squirrel, like with a little horse harness holding a sword, and it was just one of those, you know, what do I need to do to get this gig?
Yeah, exactly. This is basically an autobiographical image.
Yes, and it was very much about having an emotional connection between the player and this mouse protagonist in the game. So I wrote like a 8 or 10 minute kind of suite with different sections that kind of told the story and didn't really do a lot of explaining with text. I just wanted the music to sort of lead the way. And they ended up picking me for the composer job, which was amazing. And I got to go to Seattle.
You were gunning for voice actor. But
especially today, you know, I'm in my serious, sexy GDC voice.
Yeah, oh yeah, me too. I sound completely different than in the other interview that I recorded. It's like a different person from one 24-hour GDC period is enough to mutate me into a zombie.
It all goes downhill from Wednesday on.
Oh yeah.
But the team, it's like 12 or 14 people, mostly from the Halo studios. And they literally kind of abdicated, not because they didn't love their jobs, but because they were ready to work on something a little less violent, a little less shoot 'em up, and a little more about emotions and connecting, you know, with the players' positive emotions as opposed to all those sort of negative kinds of emotions.
It reminds me of a few years ago, John Powell kind of stopped scoring films. Mm-hmm. He went on this sort of sabbatical because he was so busy doing all the, you know, Bourne Identity films and a lot of DreamWorks films and things like that. And then he realized I have a teenage kid who I don't ever spend time with. And he didn't want to have no relationship with his son. And so he told his agent, you know, I only want to do animation and I only want to do one movie a year.
Wow.
And it was, why animation? And he goes, because it's the only place I get to write joy in earnest and it's not cheesy.
Yeah,
I get to do a How to Train Your Dragon or whatever and just be ecstatically happy. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't feel like I'm being ironic or whatever. Right. It is. And yeah, it's the same in games. That's actually really rare.
It is. And literally, Tam, the owner of the company, told me flat out, he just said, we just wanted to make a game we could play with our kids.
Yeah.
And not in a like, good job killing those aliens, son, you know, in a emotional connection sort of way.
Yeah. Well, and that, I mean, you're obviously, you being a father, you have a really close relationship with your kids. I've seen it firsthand, so I can see.
You have.
Yes, I've seen it in the form of resentment over your kids' appreciation of Journey and Abzu.
You know, I did music too, girls. That's nice. Do you know Austin's back there playing right now? I'll see you later.
Well, it's your fault for them not being allowed to play your games.
I know, right? Well, they've been playing them now, though.
That's true.
My oldest is 17, so they're actually getting to play some of those games.
Finally appreciating, like, what helped finance the, the animal farm
the
all
animal
around
farm,
us.
Farm, yeah.
That's fun. 17? That's insanity.
I know.
Well, so yes, Jason Graves, the family man, getting to express earnest emotion. That must have been. Have you ever had a game?
No.
In that, it's not even just rare, but it's literally a category of one so far.
Yeah. I mean, I even did combat music that is in a major key.
You avant-garde maniac.
I know, right? And it's just a major, like just a G major triad. Maybe there's a major seven in there every now and then, but just nice open triads. And, you know, it's all about like building confidence and like empowering the player to move forward and, you know, hope and searching for someone that you love and kind of reforming that bond, and basically the antithesis of all the stuff that I'm known for, like Dead Space or Far Cry Primal or Tomb Raider or, you know, all these games where the music is supposed to make you feel like you're going to die and be concerned for your life the entire time.
Yeah, it's been really nice to see it also get this reception, because VR games are so kind of intrinsically niche still.
Right.
But it brought me, because Sony published the game, if I remember, because I remember the score. Of course, anything you do is going to be on my radar just by virtue of it being you. But I remember it was getting notice, and then a particularly happy thing was when the Royal Philharmonic about a year ago May did a concert of, you know, music from the lineage of Sony games, PlayStation 1 through you know, God of War, basically. And and Moss ended up on the concert. And I'll never forget, Jessica Curry was kind of the host. And she came out and she said, "Now this next score is going to charm the pants off of you."
I love Jess so much.
And she's terrific. And it was true. And what a change of pace on that concert. You know, because literally it was like God of War and you know, just one endless sort of barrage of mayhem after another. So yeah, it's been really nice. Hopefully this you can be giving Gareth a run for his money in the emotional action music category. So why don't you back up then and give us a sense I have one other question, because you worked with one of my absolute favorite human beings on that, which is Maluka. Did I facilitate that? No, it was Far Cry.
Yes.
That you guys where she was screaming. And
I was, and oh my gosh, that was so, I just told the story yesterday because it's such a great story. So there were three kind of tribes in Far Cry, and one of them was supposed to be sort of mystical and magical in their religion. And I was basically, for like a year and a half, ever since I'd heard Maluka on your scores, been dying to find a reason to get her in. And I was like, this is it. This is perfect.
She is a magical.
You know, I love her vocals, and I can get her in that lower, like really cool timbre and do some neat stuff with some harmonies. And we did, and it was great. And about a week later, they came back and they said, okay, so change of direction. That tribe's now basically cannibals that will kill you and like eat your heart while you're still alive. So we just need it to be, you know, like really scary. You can do that, right? Ha ha ha. And I was like, oh man, like what happened to cool and mystical? So I had a Skype call with Maluka and said, look, this has gone in a completely different direction, but I still really want to work with you. But I don't know, you know, if you'd feel comfortable, because what I'd really love is for you to just scream a lot of crazy stuff and like kind of Native American war cry sort of things. And I can give you some of the language of this tribe, but I want to get your stuff first, maybe just based on one little track that I send. I'm going to write the music around that and like kind of use it as a feature, even though it's like, you know, these crazy sounds. And
we're going to need multiple takes of that demonstration.
Yeah. Well, she could really, you know, she's got a really beautiful dark tone, but she can really get.
Yeah, I didn't know she had that in her.
I don't think she knew she had it in
her. Yeah, it was really effective, though.
I mean, it really like totally pushed me to make the music sort of match that like emotional high note that
cannibalism.
She was hitting, like literally and figuratively. And we laughed about it all the time. And she even recorded herself doing it a couple times.
Yeah, I saw a little snippet. That's how I realized it was her and what was going on.
Yeah.
It's because, like, on Twitter, this video of her screaming her guts out. And what's funny is people don't realize she's the sweetest, most gentle. And she did some Twitch streaming of playing that game.
Right.
And she's, like, running up to kill, like, a mastodon or whatever. The big sort of prehistoric elephants. And she's like, I don't want to hurt it. I don't want to hurt it. And she's like crying practically as she has to hunt. And then that same apparently with just a little nudging from Mr. Graves, turns into a cannibal pretty convincingly.
It was a good gig, but it wasn't really what I wanted to do with her. Then I did something with Ready at Dawn when we were sort of checkerboarding games with them. You were working on
Deformers,
and I was working on Lone Echo.
Mm. And she sings on Lone Echo?
She does.
I didn't even realize that.
And that game is a lone female astronaut, like surrounded by all this technology. So I pretty much used her as the vocal and the melody, and then everything else was synths. And with her permission, I took her vocal and used it a lot more than just the main melody that she sang. So I was sort of digitally manipulating her vocal, you know, the way the character in the game was sort of being digitally either oppressed or supported by all of the technology around her. And that was super cool, but it was a very short, it was like maybe 25 minutes of music. So with Moss...
Still, it's like one of the most acclaimed VR titles yet made.
I know, the Echo Arena's really gone a long way with the esports thing, which is...
It's pretty insane.
Which is very cool. With Moss, I don't know why. I think I sort of had those two chances with her, but I still hadn't really been able to go back to that kind of mystical, magical thing.
The definitive Maluka.
Yeah, exactly. And I left Seattle and just had this suite that I wrote kind of as the demo. But before I started in the game, for some reason, I just really felt like I needed to write a song with Maluka, but only if she could do it. And we talked a little bit and found the right key. And I had the melody already and came up with some lyrics and gave her like a rough sketch. And of course, she did an amazing job, and then built up the song after that, played all the instruments and got it all mixed, and then she did the final version, and that was the first thing that was written for Moss.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So all of those melodies...
That must have set the tone incredibly for the team.
It set everything. I mean, it had an electric bass and drum set in it, because it was a little more poppy, but other than that, it was all the same instrumentation that the rest of the score used. I love the idea of, if you played the game, and I didn't know if they'd want to do this or not. I didn't know if they wanted the song at all. And I said, this doesn't even count in my minutes budget. I just need to get this out.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I need to work with her and work through this. It would be great to play through the game and then at the end credits have this song play, like a film, except instead of a tagged on licensed track that no one cares about, it actually has depth and meaning and it tells the story of the game.
I mean, that's the way, that's the classic tradition of... I mean, like, probably the most successful of all time would be My Heart Will Go On from Titanic. And its melodies, you just heard that melody for 2 hours.
Yep.
So it's no wonder people grab onto it. That's awesome. I absolutely love, I remember hearing it and thinking, you know, that's not very Gravesian. and it's a great, you mentioned something that I wanted to bring up also. It's a good sort of pivot, because so much of my conversation with Gary was about, you know, where we record, the kinds of instrumentation that we record in. And you know, we were talking about the different size groups in BioShock and the different iterations it went through. And in interesting contrast to that, you play quite a lot of the material that's in your scores yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to, like, on Moss, you said you played a lot. I know there were also, like, intimate, like, didn't Kristen Nagus play on that as well?
All the woodwinds, which is amazing.
She's the Swiss Army knife gift to composers, plays all the things.
And Jeff Ball played violin.
Oh, right, immensely. And so these are all people recording in home studios, and you're stitching it together at your place.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people probably don't realize that that's actually a pretty normal workflow these days for us. You know, we pluck specific musicians that we like for the, she's in Florida. Jeff is, I think he's in LA.
In LA,
he didn't used to be.
He moved from Seattle.
Maluka's in Mexico.
Right.
So you want to walk us through that, your process there? Cause you play quite a few things. You're a drummer, percussionist.
Jack of all trades, master of none kind of thing.
Well, but that's the nice thing about being a composer is you can go bar by bar
have to. Yep. Yeah. I mean, I played in bands in high school and college. So I played, you know, bass guitar or keyboards or guitar or drums. So that's kind of my
So basically you
wheelhouse.
No one joined you in the band is what you're saying. You're like, I put postings, no one showed up. Apparently Graves wasn't goth enough.
Yeah. Right. Why is he trying to do all this happy music?
Yeah, exactly. but yeah, I mean, it's even on big orchestral scores where you're recorded in London or Nashville or whatever, I feel like there's invariably lots of you playing and tracking. And
especially, I've actually never recorded live drums with other people. I just do it all myself.
Is that coming from a control freak place, or is it just the joy of music making, or some combo, or?
Yeah, I really like doing it. It's so much fun playing, and a lot of times it just makes more sense because I have, over the last 10 years, you know, bought so many microphones and so many instruments and things like that. If I need a certain kind of sound, percussion especially is such a wild and varied wilderness of sounds. So you would sit there and spend 10 minutes like, no, not that one. Well, how many different shakers do you have? And I'll just grab all my shakers and in 2 seconds find one I need and play the part. And it just, it's all for, you know, the more small, intimate things.
As I recall, even on like The Order, you were tracking, I mean, it's like all recorded, you know, at Abbey Road, and yet there's layers of you playing all the percussion. So it was never a function of the intimacy of the project. Like, it's not like a budget thing of, you know, we can hire 90 musicians, but 91 is a cutoff. Sorry.
I definitely love playing. Especially, you know, being able to like pick up a guitar or a bass or a ukulele or an accordion or something that, you know, I don't get to play ukulele every day. But on Moss, I did. And it's just, you know,
How did you resist the very Jason temptation to start tuning it weirdly and doing kind of weird experiments with it?
Yeah, like the detuned experimental, you know, prepared acoustic guitar or something.
Yeah,
like that.
Exactly.
I've done plenty of that. It was just really nice to be able to, like, just play a major chord on a ukulele and have it, you know, not have to worry about it hiding or it's going to be too happy or anything like that. So I really embrace that. And a lot of the songs I wrote on either guitar or ukulele first.
I guess it's dawning on me that you did have one small indie title that you did, a local homegrown production that was the closest thing to any of this. Is this the first time you've ever been asked about, I'm forgetting what it's called.
Fat Chicken.
Fat Chicken.
Yeah.
Is this the first interview you're doing about, we're going to only talk about that game from here on out. I want a cue by cue analysis, like Song Exploder. That had a very earnestly, I mean, it's like silly, but it had an earnestly happy vibe.
It was. There were some songs in a major key there. But that was about factory farming.
So that's the underbelly of
exactly of
nastiness.
So there was always,
I didn't even realize that,
you know, some weird meter changes or like kind of funky chord progressions. It was always intentionally sort of like slanted and a little off kilter.
I see.
But yeah, that was fun. They had a real small budget. I did the whole thing in a week and just had fun like writing fun quirky music.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it was all live. A bunch of
That's another thing worth pointing out is because you're tracking so much stuff yourself. One of the little cheats that we realized, I think, collectively as a community at some point is that you can hide a bunch of samples behind even just one live guitar, one live violin, because the ear can't ignore the human thing in the mix.
Yep.
So you can have what would be an 80 piece orchestra playing completely through samples. And then this was my big sort of concession. I mean, Journey ended up being all live, but but all the initial mock-ups and the demo and even the original trailer that's out there is the one cello on the very front of the mix, very almost overly self-consciously, because behind it are all these strings that are horribly mocked up, but no one ever flagged it because you've pulled real mountains out of molehills over the course of, where stuff, you know, I was just astonished by what you were doing with essentially pre-recorded or sampled elements because of that. So with that as a pivot, if I may, obviously your most sort of celebrated work, at this point it's hard to pick one, to be frank. You'll make it up to me at the bar. Like Gary, the body of work is pretty spectacular at this point. But there's no question that the thing that may sort of your reputation hang on for forever, and rightfully so, or at least justifiably so, would be Dead Space. And so, why don't you? Because you were doing film and TV kind of stuff in LA before you ever really got into games, at least before that title exploded.
Yeah.
Why don't you give us the kind of capsule rundown of how you went from bright-eyed young Jason to Dead Space Jason before we actually get into Dead Space?
Well, I actually had done no horror games or any horror films or anything like that before Dead Space.
But so just walk me through a little bit about what your career was like before you before that game.
Well, I went to USC, and they had
you pointed at me because apparently,
well,
because I also went to USC. I own that now.
Yeah. There's no camera here. I can point anywhere I want, can't I?
It's true. Yes, you can. You can. No one knows that you've just been flipping me off continuously yeah. And getting the double middle finger for about the last 20 minutes.
And you know how the program is. They have some amazing composers sort of come through the doors, and sometimes it's just for an hour thing, like Jerry Goldsmith came in, and other times composers awesome. Will stick around, and Christopher Young was one of the guys that stuck around.
The maestro of horror.
And I really loved his score to Hellraiser, plus a bunch of the other stuff that he had done, and I was the guy, you know, in undergrad that already read the entire theory book yeah. and the music history book and was just like, I was Hermione in music school. So when
same hair and everything.
Yeah, yeah. When Chris came in, I like gravitated to him like white on rice and was there all the time. And
well, he must have loved you too.
Out to his car and was asking him tons of stuff. And the first thing he gave me, like on the third week, maybe, was like, this is everything you need to know about scoring music. And it was his personal copy of the Alien score.
The Goldsmith.
The conductor score.
Wow.
Yeah. He's like, I need
Jason,
it.
Jason.
I need it back I in 24 hours. This. Yeah. So I was like, I'll go to Kinko's right now, Mr. Young. And I, you know, went to Kinko's and copied. They didn't have PDFs back then.
Yeah.
But that was sort of the groundwork.
Is it the whole score?
Yeah, the whole score.
How did he get that?
I guess he got it from Jerry. I say Jerry because he calls him Jerry because, you know, he said that's where he – because I was asking about Hellraiser.
Yeah.
And he was just like, here you go. Here's Hellraiser.
Wow.
It's Alien.
Yeah.
I mean,
Chris Young is one of the most giving of himself. This yes. is a guy who bought – He was trying to help out young composers in town. Mm-hmm. So he bought a house where composers can stay
yeah.
for the first 6 months. If they've moved to LA to try to make a career, he gives them a artificially depressed rent
mm-hmm.
house where he's just eating. He's just losing money all the time in order to give someone a place to get on their feet where they're paying like a couple hundred bucks a month or something yeah. like that in order to survive. And he just
so amazing.
Constantly has this round robin of young composers. And it's one of those where I'm like, I really hope that he's got like a financial advisor or somebody who's making sure this is okay, because he's so obscenely generous that I worry he's going to eat himself out of house and home for the sake of his giving nature. I didn't realize that with the Alien score. That's such a cool and very typically Chris.
Yes, of course. So that's the first thing I fell back on when my agent at the time basically said EA is doing a new horror game. And
you keep resisting my desire to learn about your life before Dead Space came along, though, because you were doing like library music, I think.
Yeah, and lots of library
music. You had a whole kind of career.
Commercials. I ghost wrote for a couple of composers when I was in LA for the 2 years that I was there. Like some Jackie Chan movies and
wow,
a bunch of Activision commercials and Honda commercials and commercials for the Army and. We recorded at Capitol Records with a live orchestra. The guy I worked
for the
with,
Army.
Yeah, for the Army.
Wow.
Yeah, the guy I worked for did the Intel logo. That was his, you know, dun 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 dun.
That's so his contribution to civilization.
He wrote that, yeah. Royalty free, of course. I was yeah. like, oh man, that's too bad.
That's like Michael Levine as a violinist in LA who wrote the Kit Kat jingle. And he's like, you know, it's considered like. It's like debated about if it's the number one earworm of all time. And
Marty may debate that.
Well, yeah, it's true. It's true. Flintstones vitamins. I always delight in people discovering that the Halo composer is also, and I love his Twitter. His Twitter bio is like composer of Halo, Destiny, and Flintstones vitamins.
Yeah. At dinner last night, he said, I'm still getting money from Flintstones. I was like, and you should be.
That's wow. That wasn't, royalty free.
No.
Holy crap. No. But Halo probably was.
Yeah.
That's funny or tragic. In any case, circling back.
Funny.
So you were working with Intel composer man doing Army music at Capitol Records. At some point you made the decision to go back to Raleigh.
I did. I moved back to North Carolina because I had some independent films at the time. Dawson's Creek was being filmed in Wilmington, and as well as some other show. And there were some indie films up and coming, and I just wasn't really feeling L.A. Very, very, very busy. I mean, like, so busy, like, getting up at 3 in the morning to go to the studio and work all day and going home at midnight and doing that 7 days a week. But it just wasn't, well, musically fulfilling. Mm-hmm. And I kind of figured I'd rather go get a real job or work at the coffee shop I worked in before I went to college and do these indie films on the side and enjoy writing music than being put through this, like, meat grinder of a system, being at the bottom of the totem pole, you know, doing like reality TV. And I was fortunate though, because I was really busy. Like 2 months into school, I started working for this guy and basically kind of stopped going to school. Not basically, I stopped going to school. I would show up for the recording sessions and get like daggers from all the other students because they knew I wasn't going to school. That's because funny. I was working. And I remember
I had a similar experience. Yeah. And I never realized we were so in parallel.
We're always in parallel.
I
man.
Know. It's so they don't. We're now we're holding hands. Yes, I know. I'm blushing, Jason. But that's amazing. I mean, you know, that's it for so many. That is basically the dream. But I think one of the things I'm always trying to tell students is listen to your soul, mm-hmm. as it were. If you're not loving it, you have to make sure that this mental kind of intellectual commitment to the idea isn't overriding this voice in you saying, I'm not happy. Because there's no shame in saying, turns out I don't love this the way I thought I did. Mm-hmm. You know, just because I racked up a bunch of student debt and put all this time and energy into investing in it doesn't mean I have to do it. And the self-awareness of like, you know what, I would rather do an indie film and work at a coffee shop and move back to Raleigh. That there's a self-awareness. How old were you at the time?
It was grad school age. So
22, 23 or something like that? Yeah, that's a self-awareness that not a lot of folks have. Because it's just so much about like, you're just paying your dues. Just stick it out, you know? Be a man. Of message where it's like.
I told myself that for the first summer I was out of school. I was like, I'm going to give it the summer and it can't be as, because now school's over and I don't have to worry about all this pressure of feeling guilty and not going to class. And I called my folks and I was like, I don't know what to do, because do I go to class to listen to this composer who's brilliant talk about when he worked on TV shows in the 80s that I love, or do I finish my TV show that's due tomorrow?
Yeah.
And my dad's like, well, why did you go to California? You want to write music, right? Go write music.
Yeah.
And the director, Buddy Baker, of the program completely understood. He's like, you're fine. And he gave me the certificate, whatever graduate diploma thing at the end, and wished me well. But after that summer, it just got worse.
Yeah.
It was just, I'm a hard worker. Don't get me wrong. I'm not complaining that it was too busy or anything. It was just not,
it's the flavor.
It's not fun.
Yeah.
Like
for
my heart wasn't in it. And it just wasn't the kind of thing at the time, you know, you're broke in L.A. and just so I moved back home and we literally moved in with my in-laws for the next 6 months. And I literally worked at that same coffee shop and did these indie films and slowly but surely started doing some other local things for about 5 years, built up a local reputation for writing music for, you know, industrial videos.
I was gonna say, what's the local market even like in Raleigh, North Carolina?
Hey, I recorded and encoded the very first surround sound handbell DVD.
Okay, noted. That is new information.
Probably not in the Guinness Book of World Records, but they were.
You're
very
no Tommy Tallarico.
Yeah, definitely not.
Well, I mean, actually, it's funny because especially these days with a lot of the film incentives, the funny thing is there probably is a lot of, I mean, I don't know what North Carolina's is like, but there's a lot of states in that area that pretty aggressively try to bring in productions.
Atlanta's huge right now.
Yeah. So it's in the neighborhood, as it were. But at some point in there, then you started getting plugged into games.
I did. I kind of stumbled across my first one. I was doing newsletters, like these things called newsletters, where you would fold up paper and put a thing called a stamp on it and put it in the mail to people.
I saw this at a museum once.
Yeah.
It's like at the Guggenheim.
Uh-huh. I was sending out monthly newsletters to about 200 people. And half of it was just talking about music that I'd written locally, but the other half always talked about what I did in L.A. And there seemed to be sort of this idea that I was somehow an L.A. composer that had moved to North Carolina. where I was actually just a North Carolina composer who lived in LA for a few
years.
Had
a brief foray, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So it was just, I ended up hooking up with someone in town who knew I could do orchestra stuff, and they did like non-orchestra stuff. And I helped them out a little bit, and then kind of stumbled across a game that was just a matter of knowing someone who knew someone in Australia, which is literally the opposite side of the world. And they were doing a game called King Arthur based on the movie King Arthur that came out in 2003 or something like that. And literally they said, oh yeah, we need music. Maybe we should do something about that. You know, the game, you know, film-based tie-in games.
Licensed titles are a notorious sort of drudgery.
Especially back then. It was basically like, what can we grab from the film and make the gameplay, and we have to have it out before the movie comes out.
Yeah, and I think the Walking Dead game in 2012 was like the first licensed title that people were like, this is just earnestly a good game.
Yeah, it actually stands on its own.
Yeah, and there have been a few, but yeah, it's just the constant. Because it's like no one cares. They're just cynically like, fans of the movie might give us a few extra dollars. Right. So there's no incentive to make a good game. I didn't even know that existed, that King Arthur game. Like, this is a lot. You recorded orchestra?
No, it was all samples. But I went. So my experience in LA was this. We'd work on like the Intel Pentium 3 was what I was doing at the time with my boss. So we would do like 50 or 60 variations of that each day. And play it to Sony. And it was literally just a spreadsheet. Like, well, which one? Okay, combine this one with that one. Or we'd be doing like a Honda commercial, not having the job yet because it's all on spec, right? Mm. Version after version after version of a 30-second spot over like 3 or 4 weeks. And working really hard at doing that. And you kind of lose, your heart's not in it anymore. So that's basically why I ended up leaving.
Advertising is brutal. Yeah.
Well, with the game, I had... I think it was only maybe 40 minutes of music, and I had like 4 weeks to do it. So I did 10 minutes of orchestra music a week, and the only feedback I ever got was, that's great, when are you sending the next cue? And it was sort of
that
like...
felt very different.
An epiphany. It was like, this is creative, this is creatively fulfilling. You know, I feel like I'm contributing something meaningful, even if it is a silly game.
And they actually appreciate the work.
Yeah. Yeah,
like they're excited to work with you, and you're not just this necessary evil that they have to grudgingly accept.
So that was basically me redirecting my sights from kind of local, you know, insurance things or political ads or whatever to, I want to do more games. I want to do more of that. I want that experience again, because those people were super cool, even though I never talked to them. We only emailed, but they were super cool, super supportive. I had so much fun working on it. I learned so much. You know, orchestration and MIDI, I'd been doing tons of stuff on my own anyway. So I was ready to go when the call came, but it was an eye-opener for sure.
It's funny how parallel that is with the story Gary told yesterday about how the idea of, you know, being ready when the moment comes.
Yeah.
Because he had done, you know, they wanted very specifically Bernard Herrmann-esque stuff for Destroy All Humans. Mm-hmm. And he had done that on a game in like 1993. It's a very novel sort of CD-ROM game that they had recorded live orchestra, and he tells the story of they asked him to write a demo, and he refused because he said, I have music that's already produced that's exactly your direction. If I give you samples on some new demo, it's just going to be a downgrade of this thing I already have. And he said no, and he got the job. Mm-hmm. And then that eventually led to BioShock, and it's the same story here of like, You had a whole career of doing stuff that wasn't necessarily your jam, that prepared you for when that moment came.
Absolutely.
and then you were primed and ready to strike, and in the headspace also needed to kind of fully engage. It represented an escape, because Gary said a similar thing. He said BioShock particularly was the first time he felt like a real composer.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was like, please be an artist, give us real music. And
right.
And there seems to be a bit of a theme of that, of people especially coming from advertising.
Yeah.
I guess we all don't have Flintstone vitamin
right
situations. So then obviously you started doing more and more games.
Mm-hmm.
So this eventually leads to Dead Space.
Mm-hmm.
What year was, like, 2008 or something like that?
I think 2006 was when they were actually doing the pitch. And I'd done a bunch of World War II games and stuff like that, but all MIDI, nothing live. They had no budget, lots of stuff for Ubisoft. But like the Excel sheet kind of way of working. Combat 1 through 10, Explorer 1 through 10.
Right.
Five pieces of some art that I could print and put around my screen. And just
for a long time, that seemed to be
inspired.
The norm.
Yeah,
yeah,
that was pretty much the way it was done. With Dead Space, they referenced The Exorcism of Emily Rose,
Christopher Young again,
and I was like, I could do something like that. Not right now, because no samples exist that you can do something like that with. But I have something I did when I was in school that was actually a cue I wrote under Chris that I could present as sort of an idea. And I put together like one other example doing silly MIDI, you know, writing little clusters and things like that with the computer. And they had tried to hire Chris, but he wasn't interested.
Really?
Yeah.
I never knew that.
Yeah.
Imagine that.
And
what a different world we'd be living in.
I know, right? And somebody else, basically, they kind of, once they got to my agent, they had exhausted all avenues of opportunity.
So available and cheap is the MO to take away from this story.
And apparently had heard other composers' things as well before they got to the submission that I sent. And the audio director literally called, like, when he heard it and said, this is exactly what we're looking for. When can you start? Like, no one else has submitted anything like this. I don't think they get it. I don't know what the deal is, but this is what we need.
Well, I'll tell you from my perspective, I'll never forget, because we didn't know each other, and I had not heard of you prior to that game.
Yeah, of course.
And I remember the game comes out and starts making all these waves, and I see an interview, you know, Jason Graves talks about the music of Dead Space. And I'm always curious about what friends or colleagues or future colleagues or future friends are up to, and I'm just a general soundtrack nerd. And I read the interview, and here's the thing: I have a low tolerance for composer grandstanding.
Yeah,
because there's a lot of people that, you know, it's like if someone gets a daytime Emmy nomination for best sound effect, their bio instantly says Emmy nominated composer. You know, there's a certain amount of like, I won the film festival award at the Sioux City, Iowa, like short animal themed film festivals. So I'm an award winning composer. Like there's a certain amount of, and I get it because everyone wants to look, you know, it's
rise
peacocking basically,
norm.
You know, everyone's trying to do their best. And I sympathize with that, but I still have a kind of aversion. So I remember I read this interview where you're like, yeah, we did these recordings. I'm reading you my perception of
great,
your voice. You're like, so yeah, we're doing these recordings. And I mean, it's just like the samples aren't sophisticated enough to capture my genius. And so I told them, we have to record, you just have to accept the recordings after I make them, because I'm going to have to go and no library could capture what I'm trying to do.
The bountiful plenty of my the inspirational genius.
The forward-thinking musical mind that is Jason Graves. So I'm reading it and I'm like, who the fuck does this guy think he is? And then I went and listened to like 1 second of Dead Space and I went, there's no fucking way you could mock this up. I was immediately, instantly converted and just thought, this guy, he, if anything, he soft-sold it. This is the real deal. Hyper aggressive. This is someone who knows how to write this way too, because it's not, you don't go to the Hollywood Bowl and kick back with a glass of wine and listen to this kind of stuff.
Thank
this is reach into your soul level. Like John, I remember once reading a description of John Corleone's Altered State that said something like, rarely if ever has more terrifying music been put to film. And I had the same reaction. I was like, we'll see. And then 5 seconds later of listening to that, it's like, I'm breathing, there's mist coming out of my mouth as the room is suddenly weirdly cold. And I'm like
fetal on the floor.
Yeah, exactly. And it was the same reaction. It was really, really impressive. So explain to us what you did there, because, I mean, there's really no score even since then, I feel like, that has achieved that level of just visceral mayhem.
Visceral mayhem is a good catchphrase.
Your band name that no one would join you.
A great metal band I had in the 60s. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was interesting. So actually, there was about 15 minutes of music I wrote for Dead Space that wasn't included because they had a slightly different pitch where it was more like a Will Smith sci-fi movie. So it's got a little bit of dissonance in it.
Okay.
But it's supposed to be a little more heroic. So it sort of had that pointy kind of...
just the occasional Stargate.
Octatonic thing.
Yeah.
And very bouncy and odd meters, but a little more empowering. And that's kind of the direction they said they wanted to go. And I was like, well, that's not the music that I sent. And he's like, well, we're trying something. This was a team of, I mean, I think 30 people worked on it for a year and a half all by themselves.
Wow.
And then I was brought in. And then we worked on it for about another year and a half. And then they went large after the first major vertical slice and kind of, you know, imitated the style that we came up with. But it was a year and a half of experiments. So we did that. And then he came back about 2 months later. And he's like, okay, change of plans. We just need you to write the scariest music that's ever been written in the history of music. Like, we don't want to empower the player. We want to terrify them all the time and convince them they're going to die at any second. And I was like, well, I can do that.
It's a serious crowd pleaser.
Yeah. I mean, it's like everyone's greatest hits, right? Yeah. I did my undergrad before I went to USC. My professor was very, very 20th century. So he was very much all about like John Cage and 12-tone.
Stockhausen. And
oh, yeah. All that. Like the more out there and non-melodic, the more he liked it.
The stuff that is the reason why as a civilization, no one likes classical music anymore.
Pretty much.
Yeah, the thing that chased millions of people away from concert halls.
I mean, I think there's a place for it, but, you know, I'm...
Namely, games like Dead Space.
Yeah. I'm not a huge advocate of, you know, I don't want to be commissioned to write that kind of music for a living. It's not really a passion-driven
Ironically,
kind
you
of
basically
genre.
Were for 10 years.
Yes, I was.
Still bear the scars. I mean, it was really... And so you, if I remember correctly, you basically hand-wrote out just piles and piles of these... phrases and gestures and monstrous things, and then recorded it with no mock-ups, right?
Yeah.
Kind of built a custom library that had no precedent.
They wanted to do four completely independent stereo streams of music that played simultaneously, which had never been done before. They had their own custom audio engine. And then they had stingers that could fly in on top of those four. And they wanted it to be completely, well, he didn't say orchestra. He didn't say death metal. He didn't say found sound. He just said the scariest music ever. Well, I just fell back to like The Shining.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, that's one of the most terrifying films because of Penderecki's stuff.
Yeah. And Ligeti.
Yeah, exactly. And I had like 6 months where the Chapel Hill Music Library is actually a really, really UNC Chapel Hill has an amazing music library. I spent days there photocopying like Ligeti and Penderecki and a couple of others, but I really gravitated towards the Penderecki. And I started seeing things that Goldsmith had obviously lifted a very good way for Alien or for Planet of the Apes, or that Williams had used in Close Encounters, like Barry's kidnapping and cues like that. So I could see the original, because Penderecki is the original.
Yeah.
He wrote Threnody for the victims of Hiroshima, like still in school, and won like the National Polish Composition Award that year.
You know, that piece very famously... You know, it has these clusters where it's like 50 strings all playing different notes, right? And it's this violent, violent dissonance. And he notated it in this way that was pretty innovative at the time of just putting a big black box.
Yeah, he invented all these graphics.
Yeah. And I once read an interview where they said, how'd you come up with this idea of like just this graphical sort of notation? He said, well, I was in a coffee shop and I just didn't have room in my space to kind of spread out. So instead of writing out, because like Ligeti was the opposite. It's like 10,000 part divisi.
Yep. Every individual
single
stave for each instrument.
Every member of the orchestra has their own part that's different from everybody else. And Ligeti was like, I mean, Penderecki just sort of like was putting essentially a Sharpie across the music and just saying, play any note within this.
Wiggle, 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 wiggle line, straight line, dotted dots. Yeah.
And how effective. So yeah, that was the education sort of ramp up to it. In other words.
Yeah. The audio director had been with EA for 18 years. He'd done all the Lord of the Rings games and stuff. Wow. So he had a lot of clout. And apparently I found out after the fact that some of the executive producers were actually pushing for like a heavy metal, dark, like grungy.
Mick Gordon.
Kind of
ahead
vibe.
Of the curve.
Yeah. 20 years earlier. Yeah. But he shielded me from all that. And he let me do whatever I thought was responsible.
That's
and
a really good audio director.
Yeah. You know, you don't get that a lot nowadays because a lot of the audio directors are younger and a little more green. And there's, I think, an innate fear of being responsible for like messing something up if you try something different. But Don Vecka had been around forever. And I told him that I could do everything he needed, but that there was no way to do it with samples. You had to record it live. I couldn't do any mock-ups. And I couldn't even, like, if he came to the session, he'd just be listening to violins making funny sounds for 3 days. It wouldn't be a piece of music. And I said this thinking, you know, we're going to take your $50,000 budget and spend every dime before you hear a note of music. And there's no way of getting that back. So there's no way you're going to agree to this. And he just shrugged and said, great, let's do that.
So you convinced them. They did not fire you or reject this idea.
Right.
You convinced them that this was a good idea. Did they actually come to the sessions and sit there with bemused looks on their face, or did you just show up like a knight in armor with a pile of crazy
recordings? He was there. Yeah, he showed up at the session. But, you know,
was this a Skywalker? Or is this a net?
Yeah, okay. Skywalker. The phrase "enough rope to hang yourself" was pretty much banging around in my head the entire time, and I kept calling him saying, "I've got this great idea," and he go, "That sounds really cool." And like the second time, he literally said, "Dude, whatever you do is going to be great. I trust you. You don't need to keep running this by me. I'll see you at the session." I was like, "That does not make me feel any better."
That's fantastic.
And really, it was all like, not even gestures or anything. It was very like, let's record all the violins playing their highest note possible as quiet as they can for 20 seconds. Now let's get them to play it again as loud as they can for 20 seconds. Now let's get them to repeat these notes randomly as fast as possible for 20 seconds quiet and now for 20 seconds loud. Literally building a library of sounds that I came home with 45 minutes of material every hour because there were no wrong notes.
Yeah. Right.
So I had like hours, I mean like 10 or 12 hours of material, and then the rest of my life for Dead Space 1 consisted of building a contact instrument in the morning in panic-stricken fear of not being able to live up to this $50,000 budget they had spent, and then in the afternoon writing a piece of music with that new sound that I had built in contact and then delivering it.
Well, it paid off in droves. I mean, it was like I said, the first time I heard it, I just was blown away. I'd never heard a score of that sophistication in and just sheer violence. I mean, it was just so incredibly terrifying. And people talk about it still. Like, they play the game.
Yeah.
And usually it's melodic, tuneful kind of things where people after the fact remember me. Like, they talk Final Fantasy always, you know.
Sure.
Like, oh, the first time you see Sephiroth, I'll never forget that melody. And that's a very common sentiment. Or Mario, you know, like, these staples, Zelda, etc. A mutual friend of ours, Grant Kirkhope, has like 30 years of sycophantic acolyte fans built on the piles of amazing tunes he's written. And yet Dead Space was that anomalous outlier where it was like, oh, I really remember the music, and it took 10 years off my life. Like, I'm not a,
me
not
too.
I'm not a better person. And yet it's so effective. And so that set the tone. You won all the things. You won all the
BAFTAs such a
and gang awards. And
I mean, wasn't expecting a thing, honestly, because it was so visceral and non-musical and over the top. It's like, no one's going to want to listen to this.
Actually, well, here's where I'll disagree with you. It's extremely musical. It's just not a musical vocabulary that we
pleasingly
listen
so.
To. Yeah, but like, that's the thing. That's why it's not a wall of sound. That's, I think, why, as I maybe analyze my own reaction back then, it felt like a composer wrote this. It wasn't just sound effects libraries of gestures that are being stitched together like Lego blocks.
Right, right.
Because there's a big difference between those. Because any sound designer can take shrieking violin sound 1x3-4 and just put it on a timeline in Pro Tools and play it back and say, like, yeah, here's my piece. But that's not at all what this is. I mean, it's real. Plus, I guess they also were able to be very dynamic in game with how granular these parts were. Because I remember that also about the games. The music was super reactive.
And constantly playing all the time. Half the time it sounded like room tone. I think the favorite technique I did, I had all the strings in the room at once. The instruction was just like, pick a random note. And like, half the violas put up their hands. I'm like, no, any note. It doesn't matter. Really, just pick any note.
I need instruction.
Yeah, exactly. They like yearn for the shepherd. And so I had 60.
Good thing
60,
the animal man. Is
yeah, exactly. Like
them.
60 or 65 string players. I got this like 65 note jazz chord.
Oh, that's great.
And it, you know, play it quietly. Okay, play that same note and I play it really loud. And I did like 6 or 7 takes of that. And that's half the ambience.
Isn't it a funny curve how if you have like a 4-note chord and they're kind of oddly chosen or randomly chosen notes, it's really dissonant, and then as you add more and more and more and more, it just starts to become beautiful jazz. At some point, it's an odd sort of, it's like this reverse uncanny valley of music. That's awesome. I didn't even know that part of it. So because we're short on time, there's so many others. Obviously, you worked on 2 Dead Space sequels after that,
right?
The Tomb Raider reboot a couple years ago was, and it's actually to this day one of my favorite themes of yours. It was It was one of those, like, that was one of those where if I'm demoing solo horn samples, I like to play that melody because it's just this perfect kind of regal long phrases, but leaps.
Some
that
nice
require.
Leaps. Yeah. Like,
it's a good one. But you did something for that is one of those things I really, really love, which is I have a great passion for when someone is a sort of a professional and a craftsman and an artist, but they're not afraid to be a showman. And for Tomb Raider, you had this instrument built,
right?
That was like a custom piece of sculpture.
Yeah.
And the first time I saw photos of you, kind of like, it was like a roadshow of like, yeah. I want to show you about the instrument.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that. Cause that was just, to me, that was like, this is a composer who's more than just delivering on the job. They're elevating the score they're elevating the whole medium of game music because they're giving something that the public can look at and go, I'm not going to forget that. Like,
right.
How do I forget this giant weird metal creature?
Mm-hmm.
So tell us about the instrument.
Well, I was literally in my backyard kind of scavenging around trying to find like weird things to play to sort of augment the music for the bad guys on that reboot of Tomb Raider, and thought I need to go to like a junkyard or something, but you can't take anything from junkyards, at least in North Carolina. So
like by law?
Yeah. You can only drop it off. So is there a metal shop or something?
Going late at night.
Yeah. With the barbed wire and the German shepherds and everything. Then I would really feel like.
But you're
I'm
like the animal whisperer.
Game.
I'm sure they would just stop like Ace Ventura and just yeah. kneel at your feet, you know. So,
so I called the this metal guy and just wanted to know if I could come by and look for stuff. And
to be clear, we're not talking about a metal guy in the traditional musical.
A metal smith.
Yes.
Like a welder guy, and he starts telling me where he is, and I'm sitting in my bedroom, like pacing back and forth as I'm talking to him, and he explains to me where he is, and I'm like the second door on the left? He goes, yeah. I said, is it red? He goes, yeah. I said, I'm staring at your door right now.
The call is coming from inside the house.
He's like, well, what are you talking about? And it was literally just six houses down the street from me.
Wow.
Where there was a little industrial area.
Ah, to live in Raleigh.
And he was super cool. We talked like an hour before that. So at first, I was just getting some things. And then I asked if I could have some money from Crystal for him to just like put a couple of things, like to cut some things and put some things together. And they sort of, Alex Wilmer, who I was working with for the music, one-upped me and was like, well, can we give him some money? Like, would you want to do something bigger? I was like, I'd want to do as much as we could do. So then it kind of became, well, let's use like some glass sounds and some metal sounds. I need to be able to bow some things. I want to be able to hit some things. And we just worked together over the course of about a year developing different sounds. And Matt McConnell is his name. Got to see the game and we worked out, you know, what sounded good and what sounded bad. And I let him design everything, but he designed the look of it based on the game. There's a lot of wreckage and old things on this island.
A lot of angular kind of spikes.
Rusted metal and stuff like that. So the game, the first chapter of the game is all just the instrument playing these sounds. And then all the UI in the game, I could take it in pieces to my house in the studio and set it up. So glass bowls and bowing metal, all the UI is from that as well.
I didn't know that. The sound effects people jumped on board.
Yes. And now the instrument itself, the one that I used, is in Crystal's lobby.
Yeah, that's
along
what
with
I
the
heard.
Bow that he made and everything. So you can go up and literally I've heard that they'll like walk up and go ding and they're like, ooh, achievement unlocked. Because it's literally that bell sound, you know, that particular pitch. And I think they brought it back too. They used it a lot in the third Tomb Raider.
Oh, I didn't realize.
Since the reboot, yeah.
Wow.
It had been sitting in their lobby for a while and I think they were sort of like, maybe we should use this some more.
Well, yeah, they should. I mean, you crafted between that and the theme. It's like you built a foundation for the whole, I mean, the franchise could go for 20 years and regardless of who's scoring it, they would be right to draw from that basis because it really felt earnestly like, yeah, this vision of Lara Croft is that. Mm-hmm. It felt like such a match. It was really, really good. It's one of those exciting moments from an outside perspective of saying, just when I think I've got somebody figured out in that very Goldsmithian tradition, managed to do something that really surprised me. It was really, really cool. Yeah, and then you brought it to LA and did like a pub, like an event. I remember seeing photos. It was like a BAFTA LA like concert / presentation or something where there's photos of you on stage with the instrument. And
yeah,
I was like, see, that's like the P.T. Barnum.
It was super cool. Yeah, it was. It was. And even the guys, the audio director and the music director both flew out when we were doing some interviews and, you know, video shoots for the making of the game. And I got to see, no one knew what it looked like. They'd only heard it.
Oh, that's cool.
And Matt killed himself for like the last 48 hours getting it put together for like presentation mode because he knew it was going to be like pictures that would live in infamy. So I got to walk in
with
them.
How do you even ship it?
Oh, it was like on a giant freight truck. And yeah. He had it in a box the size of a Volkswagen Beetle. I'm not kidding.
Exactly. It's not a small undertaking.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing is like 12 feet tall or something.
Yeah, it's bigger than a refrigerator. Yeah. Like a large refrigerator. But I got to see their faces when they actually saw what it looked like for the first time. They were just like eyes wide and walking over and, you know, all the mallets that I use and everything are there and they're banging on it, like hearing all these sounds that they've been hearing them for a year now. So it was very much like a full circle.
It's the it's the instrument equivalent of going, wow, you're way more handsome in person.
Yeah, right.
I would never have guessed.
What a pleasant surprise.
Yeah. Well, we have this tendency to be able to go for hours and hours and hours. And because there's so many other scores I would want to dive into. But it's GDC. The clock, the bell tolls for both of us.
The show must go on.
Yes, exactly. So is there anything you want to plug and also social media and things for people to be able to find you and stalk you and witness our public squabbles?
Yeah, JG Music is my Twitter handle. Super easy. And I've been doing a YouTube channel now for... You know,
yeah, especially for composers that catch this podcast, your channel is actually really thorough of composer techniques and
yeah,
that's a new venture for you. That seems actually like a lot of work.
It's on the technical side, it's work, but actually filming it. Now that I'm used to staring at a camera and not to like the loving eyes of Austin Wintory,
I'll film also.
I thought about putting a picture of your face up on the camera so that I'd feel a little more at home.
Yes,
but then
good.
It just seemed a little weird when I wasn't filming.
I mean, for what it's worth, all you had to do was take the photo already there and just slide it to the left so it was right above the camera.
Right. Oh, well, that's true. Take it out of the gilded gold frame
kind
of paste it over.
What I want is to send you a photo of me that you can put right behind your BAFTA award so that you can see me through the carved out
eye
hole.
Yeah, that
yes.
would be perfect.
That's my new ambition. I'm going to sneak into your house at night and make that a reality.
That
so just
perfect.
Forewarn. So JG Music, your YouTube channel, what's it called?
Audio Arc.
Yes, with your thumbnails of a different animal of yours.
A different animal. And I try to group the animals like I group the segments. I like the idea of, you know, empowering and uplifting, especially younger composers who were, you know, going through the throes and agony of growing pains, like back when I was in my 20s and 30s. Just to, you know, if I can help out a little bit, then great.
Well, I think it probably does. Well, with that, I will say thank you. We can stop holding hands.
All right.
And we'll see you next time. Thanks for listening. Thank you so much. I've been Austin Wintory. This is the Game Maker's Notebook. If you like what you heard, please feel free to leave a positive review, you know, like, subscribe, drop us a line, give us your thoughts. If you hated it, we actually want to hear from you even more. You can give us feedback on how to make it better. You can recommend to Dice that I never be allowed to host this again, that kind of thing. Either way, your comments are welcome, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you for joining us for the Game Maker's Notebook. For more information on the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences, our podcasts, and our other initiatives, please visit www.interactive.org.